This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, this is David Rutledge. You're in the Philosopher's Zone. Welcome once again to the program. I want to ask you this week, how often do you think about your dignity? Dignity is one of those things that goes to the core of what we take to be fundamental human rights. If someone doesn't have dignity, if their dignity is being threatened or compromised, then that's a moral violation to which we as a community feel we should attend. But then the thing about dignity is that it's not some sort of four-square solid object that looks the same to everyone. My idea of dignity might be different to yours. Something that you find undignified, I might think is perfectly acceptable. And that's all fine until one of us appeals to a standard of dignity that the other considers to be simply beyond the pale. So if I'm a deeply committed white supremacist and I feel my dignity is being compromised by having to use non-segregated public transport, should my culturally specific appeal to dignity be respected? And if not, why not? Well, the answer's not as straightforward as you might think, but fortunately, this week's guest has been doing a lot of really interesting work in this field. Her name is Susie Kilmister. She's a senior lecturer in philosophy at Monash University in Melbourne, and she's the author of a book that came out last year titled Contours of Dignity. Susie Kilmister is speaking with Sam Barron.
In my work on dignity, I basically started from what I see as a really tight connection between dignity and respect. Right? That's my kind of starting point. And I think we can see this in the way people talk about people who are dignified, right? There's this idea that people who are dignified command a kind of respect, right? What they're doing or the way they comport themselves is in some way respect-worthy. And on the flip side, and I think more morally importantly, I think there's this really tight connection between indignity or violations of dignity and concepts like disrespect or contempt or degradation. So at a kind of simple level, the starting point for my theory is the idea that to have dignity is to command respect, and to have one's dignity violated in some way involves disrespect. But I think when I was trying to work out all the different contexts in which dignity came up and the different ways people talked about dignity being violated, more detail on that was kind of needed. So I kind of got the detail by trying to tease apart different kinds of respect and then kind of plugging them into the theory. So the first thing we can ask when we're talking about respect is whose respect is at issue, right? We can talk about someone being respect-worthy or what they do being respect-worthy, but whose respect is being commanded, right? Are we talking about self-respect, right, our own respect for our own kind of doings, or are we talking about gaining the respect of other people? So that's the first distinction I think it's really important to kind of attend to. And then there's a second question of what exactly is involved in respect. And I think there's a couple of different kinds of respect that are relevant for thinking about dignity. The first of these is just the idea of respect in the sense of holding in high esteem, right? We might respect someone or say we respect someone because we admire them in certain kinds of ways. And we can contrast that idea of respect with respect in the sense of treating someone in accordance with their status or their role. I find that easiest to think of this in terms of something like respecting a judge by standing when they enter the courtroom, or respecting the queen by curtsying, right, when you're introduced to her. This doesn't have anything really much to do with holding them in high esteem, right? You can have whatever attitude you have towards the judge or the queen, but there's this way in which we interact with people in these certain kinds of roles or with a certain kind of status that constitutes treating them respectfully, right, for their role. So using these distinctions, right, the distinction between respect from ourselves, self-respect, or the respect of others, and this difference between holding in esteem or treating respectfully, I get this theory with these different types or strands of dignity. So the first of these is what I call personal dignity. And the way I understand that is that we have personal dignity by holding ourselves to certain kinds of standards. And to put it a bit more precisely, I think that to kind of achieve personal dignity involves doing things that we ourselves take to be ennobling, and perhaps more importantly, avoiding doing things that we ourselves take to be debasing. Social dignity is really similar to this, but rather than thinking about standards that we hold ourselves to, then we can think about standards that other people hold us to. So the idea here is that to achieve social dignity, we need to do the things that our community takes to be ennobling and not do the things that our community takes to be debasing. Just to give you a kind of example of this, right, we might, I think it's fair to say that in our contemporary society. It's undignified to urinate on the shrine, just to give a kind of contemporary example. And on my account, that would be explained by saying there just is a kind of social norm operative in our kind of community that says that it's degrading, it's debasing, it's a kind of thing that's shameful, that will get your community to look down on you if you do something like that. The final concept I have, status dignity, works a little bit differently, right? Because we're moving from this idea of respect as esteem, right? About doing things that earn either your own esteem or the esteem of your peers, or avoiding things that are going to earn you the contempt of yourself or your peers. Now we're moving to this other idea of kind of treating respectfully. So the idea of status dignity is that each of us has a lot of different kind of roles or statuses, right? We're citizens, we're members of professions, members of religious groups, perhaps, even members of humanity itself. And the idea of that is that each of these statuses comes with its own norms of treatment, right? Ways that members of the group ought to be treated because they're members of that group. Right? This comes back to my example from before about the judge, right? If you're a member of the group judge, you ought to be called Your Honor, right? That's kind of part of what comes with having that kind of status. That's what counts as respectful treatment for someone like you. So we have status dignity automatically then, just in member of our, in virtue of our membership in these kind of groups. And because of our membership in these groups, we command these certain kinds of respectful treatment. There's ways that we ought to be treated, ways that it's dignified to treat us or undignified not to treat us because of our membership in those groups.
Okay, so we've got these three notions: personal dignity, social dignity, and status dignity. I guess it would be good, I think, to just get a sense of like kind of an example in which personal dignity might get violated, because I think that there are some really important cases around that can help us to grip this notion of dignity a bit better. Can you give me an example from sort of recent times in which personal dignity violations occur?
Sure. So the idea with personal dignity, remember, is that there are certain things that each of us individually takes to be shameful, right? Or that we'd find it hard to respect ourselves if we did them, or we comported ourselves in those kind of ways. In a lot of my research, I was focused on the relationship between dignity and torture, and looking at the specific ways in which at Guantanamo Bay, the torturers were kind of identifying, focusing in on those things that the prisoners found most shameful. So there was a lot of really highly sexualized torture going on. Things like forcing men to wear women's underwear, violating them in many kinds of ways, forcing them to imitate or act out gay sex. And this is, I think, gets to the heart of why I think when we're thinking about dignity and violations of dignity, it's really important to focus on what does the person themselves find shameful, rather than try to find some kind of universal kind of ideal about, you know, what should people find shameful. Because, you know, the torture at Abu Ghraib, I mean, is horrendous for lots of reasons, and physical pain is obviously very, very important in some of this. But I think that honing in on precisely those things that people find most shameful is a really kind of egregious way that the torture operates, and it's really hinging on the damage that's done to people when they're made to feel ashamed, and how it kind of breaks their self-respect. And unless we then strip the moral, I don't mean strip morality out of the wrong of violating someone's dignity, but have an unmoralized idea of what dignity violations are, right? Because there's nothing wrong, right, with gay sex. And so in a sense, there's something mistaken about someone feeling shamed just because it's imitation of this kind of sex. But I think we, to understand the wrong that's happening here and the kind of depth of the harm that's happening here, we need to focus precisely on, you know, the person's own standards, right? What it is that they find shameful, right? That's how we're going to, I think, identify the harms at stake in something like these kinds of forms of torture that we saw at Abu Ghraib.
Okay, so that's really interesting. And I just want to drill down on this a little bit. So you're drawing this distinction between the kind of shame a person feels in virtue of something that's happened to them, and maybe some kind of objective moral standard. And this seems to be really important for the way that you're thinking about dignity. Can you just give me a sense of how that distinction works and how it might feature in a case of, say, social dignity violation?
Yeah, well, I think, again, with social dignity violations, the standards that we're held to are often not ones that we think are morally justified, right? There's all sorts of standards. We can think here about standards that women are held to, standards around, you know, our bodies and our sexual behaviour and things like that. We might think those standards are wrong and we'd be better off without them. But I think the fact that these standards exist and that we live in societies in which you know, to violate those standards earns the contempt of your peers, will predictably lead to you being looked down upon, kind of lowered in the eyes of your community. This creates a kind of vulnerability that I think we need to be sensitive to. And I think thinking about things like revenge porn, right, or other kinds of sexual humiliation, where I guess in ways that are kind of analogous to what I was just talking about with Abu Ghraib, where people hone in on these social standards and kind of force people to violate them as a way of kind of hurting them, as a way of lowering their social standing, right? And I think, again, if we don't recognize this distinction between, you know, what norms ought we be held to, which I think a lot of these sex-based norms are just kind of mistaken, and again, like I said, we'd be better off without them. But while they exist, we need to be attentive to the ways we can wrong people by forcing them to kind of violate them, right? So these standards can be kind of weaponized, right? And I think if we have a too overly moralized account of dignity where we only focus on, like I said, what we ought to feel ashamed by or what standards society ought to treat us according to, and kind of only take dignity violations to be the ones that conflict with those, then we're going to miss all this, I think, really important texture and the ways in which, you know, people are very, I think, sensitive to these kinds of social norms. We recognize them, and we recognize, like I said, how they can be weaponized, and how forcing someone to violate them is a way of hurting them, you know, all the way from primary school, where you can just pants the kid on the playground, right? We're sensitive from a very young age to the ways in which we can hurt one another by doing these kind of dignity violations to them.
Would you say then in your account that what really matters is how you are made to feel, not necessarily whether how you're made to feel is kind of objectively right or wrong? It's the vulnerability that comes from hurting someone or putting them into an emotional state that is hurtful that matters for dignity violation.
Yes, but that's a little bit incomplete. So definitely I think the focus is on, you know, what these dignity violations actually do to people and not whether the standards that are being violated are ones that we ought to objectively accept. But I think it's not just about how it makes us feel. I think with personal dignity, perhaps the way it makes us feel is a prominent thing. But I think with social dignity, the harm, obviously there's a way we feel when we've been publicly humiliated, right? Knowing that everyone's looking down on us is pretty horrific. Right? People find that often much worse than physical pain, that kind of the eyes of the community on you and that feeling of their contempt can be quite horrific. But I think there's something more than that too. I think that there's a kind of wrong that's done to you or a harm that's just about the fact that you're now lower in the eyes of your community, right? That your standing in that community has been compromised. And I think one way to maybe get at this, the way this maybe comes apart from just the kind of subjective feelings, is if someone doesn't realize that this has happened, right? I mean, we can have, and I keep coming back to revenge porn because I think it's a useful example of dignity violations. But someone can have something like this happen to them and not realize it. But the fact that they're being, you know, publicly humiliated, and the fact that those images might be circulating in their community, they are in fact being looked down upon by their peers, that's going to matter even if they don't have those subjective feelings of shame and humiliation in response to them. So mostly I think the subjective feelings are there and are really important. I don't want to downplay those. But I do think that it's not just the feelings, right, that there is this kind of social phenomenon of being lowered that is important to kind of recognize that that's happening as well.
You're listening to The Philosopher's Zone on RN. I'm David Rutledge. This week, producer Sam Barron is talking with Susie Kilmister from Monash University in Melbourne. Susie is the author of Contours of Dignity, available through Oxford University Press, and dignity is what we're talking about this week.
So you've talked a little bit about a kind of morally neutral or demoralizing approach to dignity. And so I'm curious about how you see the relationship between dignity and morality. So at one point in your book, you talk about a kind of very tempting view, which is to think that a dignity violation is always the enactment of a kind of moral harm. But you suggest it might be a little bit more complicated. So how do you think of the relationship between dignity and morality?
I see dignity as being an important moral consideration, but not a kind of unconditional one. So in this respect, I think it's kind of, I've said it, I think dignity is not just about emotional distress, but in this respect, I think it's relevantly like something like emotional distress. There's a kind of presumption that we ought not inflict emotional distress on people. And I think, you know, the starting assumption should be that we should avoid gratuitously inflicting emotional harm or emotional distress on other people. But it doesn't follow from that that we're morally entitled, right, that others never do anything that emotionally distresses us, right? Because once we're thinking about what others owe us, we have to think about the weight of those obligations and whether those obligations are kind of justified. And this is really important when it comes to something like dignity, because as we've just been discussing, what people take to be shameful, whether we're thinking about the personal standards they hold themselves to or the standards their community holds them to, these standards can be pretty noxious, right? So another example might be something like a man who finds it shameful to do housework, right? Because he's been raised in a kind of patriarchal society. Certainly we don't want to be in a position to have to say that, right, we have a moral obligation to refrain from asking that he does his share, right? And I think we can explain this by recognizing that there is some kind of, you know, emotional distress he's going through, right? You don't have to deny that he finds it shameful, but just then asking, what do we owe to him in response to that? And then I think thinking about, you know, what that burden would be on us, what it would be requiring us to do to kind of uphold his dignity in this situation. I think it's just, his dignity is not the most important consideration, right, in this kind of situation, right? And we can do that while acknowledging that, you know, there's something harmful here about the situation, but the solution's not to, you know, just uphold his dignity come what may, but to maybe help him come to see that doing housework isn't the kind of thing that you ought to be ashamed of, right? So try to lessen whatever harm someone like that is experiencing, not by helping them uphold these standards, which are really noxious, but by helping them come to see that they ought not to hold those standards in the first place.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by this picture of, you know, potential dignity violations surrounding someone who finds it shameful to do housework. And it makes me think of a couple of other examples that I think are happening now. And one of them involves people like anti-vaxxers who might say that it's a violation of their dignity to be forced to take a vaccine, or incels who might see it as some kind of violation of their dignity to be not provided with a mate. And I guess I'm worried about the idea that we might have to sort of morally recognize those claims. But it sounds like from what you're saying that there's scope to avoid having to say that those claims are, you know, morally valuable in some sense. But I guess I'm not quite sure how it is that you differentiate the kinds of claims to dignity that are reasonable and the claims that aren't from a moral perspective. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Sure. And I think the incel case is maybe the clearest to bring this out. So I think, again, on my account, I don't want to focus on, at least not as a kind of determining issue, like whether the person's own standards are reasonable or not, or true, or however we want to cash it out, right? So the issue with the incel isn't that they're mistaken to think that it's shameful not to have a sexual partner. I mean, I think they are mistaken, right? And we might want to help them come to see that. And the reason it comes back to something I said before, right? I think I want to be able to acknowledge the deep harms that were done to people in places like Abu Ghraib, even if we're only focused on cases where they were forced to violate standards that I think are wrong for people to hold, like that it's shameful to have gay sex, something like that. So, you know, there's always compromises in theorizing. And I think on my account, I'm recognizing a very, very wide scope of harm. But where I think, you know, we can avoid really, really pernicious kind of implications of this is by shifting attention from the person whose dignity is at stake and instead focus on the person or people who would be kind of called upon to do something or not do something in order to uphold this other person's dignity, right? So if we think about incels, what are they actually demanding, right? What would be required to uphold their dignity if, as they say, right, it would be deeply shameful for them not to have a sexual partner? Well, it'd have to be provided with a sexual partner, right? And what would that mean? Well, that doesn't seem compatible with sexual autonomy, right? Women's sexual autonomy, seeming the incels are by and large men, and they, what they by and large want is for a woman to be provided for them, right? So in a sense, their kind of dignity couldn't be upheld without a gross rights violation for women. So this is, I think, a quite simple case to say, right, okay, we can acknowledge their dignity is violated or their dignity is at risk or something like that. But what would be required to uphold it is just not something that in a just society we can do or what to do. So focusing on what would kind of need to be done to uphold that person's dignity helps, I think, separate something like the incel case from the Abu Ghraib case, right? Because, I mean, the standards at stake there, I want to say no, in a sense, more reasonable. But what would be required to uphold those standards in the Abu Ghraib case is pretty simple, right? Just don't torture someone, right? So the wrong of the torturing there, I think, or the wrong of the dignity violation there is a kind of come from this combination of the harm that's done to the victim and the kind of just ease with which their dignity could have been upheld, right? Just, you know, not forcing them to do these horrible things. I think the anti-vax is a little bit more complicated because what is kind of required is going to be much more dependent on things like how many of them are there, right? So, you know, if you're in a society where there's only like, you know, a small handful of people who are asking not to be vaccinated, there might not actually be much at stake, right? That doesn't put a whole burden, large burden on the rest of the community. So that might be a kind of case where, you know, assuming this is a kind of sincere belief that we say, well, you've got a kind of freedom of conscience and the burden on society is not that great that we ought to say there's no obligation to respect it. But, you know, if we're talking about someone who's, you know, working in an industry where they have to be in close contact with other people, right, and we've got large numbers of people who don't want to get vaccinated, here I think it's more structurally similar to the anti-vax case. What would be required to respect dignity in this case would just be too much, right? It's unreasonable to ask the rest of society to bear that burden, right? That burden to their health, the risk that it's going to pose to their health.
And so if we're thinking about dignity and protecting dignity, which is going to be very important in some cases, I'm interested to hear about the sorts of things that people or governments could do or do better in order to protect dignity. Do you have recommendations along those lines for how to better protect the dignity of individuals at a personal, social, or even status level?
Yeah. So, I mean, the obvious answer is like, don't force people to do debasing things. But I think a less obvious answer, and one that I think it's just as important to attend to, is for states and communities, right? This doesn't have to be a top-down thing, is providing means for people to secure their own dignity. And I think something we haven't really talked about yet, but I think is really important to acknowledge, is the ways that some people's dignity is much more secure than others, right? And that's on every strand of dignity, personal, social, and status, right? I am in an incredibly privileged position. And I don't find myself spending a lot of time worrying about, you know, finding ways to protect my self-respect. It's really secure. And nor do I find myself worrying too much about securing the respect of other people, because it's kind of there by default. You know, I have to avoid doing things that I find debasing. You know, that's not that challenging. But it's generally basically pretty easy. But I think there are a lot of people in our community for whom this isn't necessarily true, that there aren't, I think of it in two different ways, right? It can be much harder for people to avoid doing debasing things if they don't have secure means of income. And that's a really simple kind of example. There's a really nice project that's going on, I think, not surprisingly, called Share the Dignity. It's a charity that provides sanitary products to people experiencing period poverty, right? This is the kind of thing that, you know, my account's gonna highly recommend, right? These vulnerabilities people feel where they can't actually uphold the standards that you know, we hold people to, right? Don't appear in public in kind of soiled clothing, a really kind of basic standard most of us don't have to think about. But providing these kind of resources is a really central way of ensuring people can do that, living these kind of lives of dignity. I think poverty in general is just going to be a massive threat to personal dignity and to social dignity, right? That it costs money, right, to appear in public in respectful kind of ways. Even basic things like, you know, being able to buy a kid's Christmas presents, things like that, right? People can find it really shameful not to be able to do those things that we're kind of, you know, in a society where this is just a kind of expectation. So poverty, I think, it's a big problem, but obviously that's the kind of thing that's in the government's remit to address, right? And have very, very deep connections to dignity. But at, I guess, a more localized level as well, and maybe something that's important to bring out that hasn't been brought out so much because we're focused very much on dignity violations, I also have this notion in my book about what I call dignity frustrations, which are on the surface I don't look as important, but I think can be really important as well. Where the idea here is not about kind of forcing people to do things that are shameful or degrading, but just not giving them the opportunities or preventing them from doing things that are kind of ennobling, things that would earn their self-respect or the respect of others. And again, you know, for most of us in our day-to-day lives, those of us who are privileged, not something we have to kind of think about or worry about. But people, you know, for instance, in prison or in hospital or in care homes, right, often in these kind of situations, it's not only that it's kind of harder for people to avoid doing the degrading things, but there's just not opportunity to do things that, you know, would allow people to earn or maintain their self-respect or that would kind of earn them the respect of their peers. So things like having this meaningful, socially constructive activities that people can do in prison or in care home situations, that kind of thing, can be really, really valuable. Even things like, you know, we can imagine someone in a care home who, you know, takes great pride in, you know, getting themselves all dolled up in a certain kind of way, right? Like really going above and beyond in their appearance. This is something they can take pride in. If we're only focused on dignity violations, right, it would be enough to say, well, you know, make sure this person, you know, isn't in soiled clothing, right, when their family comes to visit, or make sure they're not like literally dribbling food on themselves when they eat in the shared dining hall. You know, obviously that's very important, but I think it's not enough, right, just to avoid kind of shame and humiliation. It's also really important to actively be able to enjoy self-respect. And so even things like providing in these kind of spaces where people can't provide it for themselves, providing the means to kind of do these things, whatever they are, that individual finds gives them pride, right? And that means being attentive to, you know, the particular needs and desires of that individual. And obviously, you know, again, maybe comes back to money, I suppose, at the end of the day, right? That's going to require having care homes that are better funded, right, with a higher staff to patient ratio, where there's actually time, right, to get to know patients, work out what it is that they need and enjoy, and providing those, you know, might not be costly, but might be time consuming, little things that are just going to give them that opportunity to do those things that they can take pride in.
Susie Kilmister, she's Senior Lecturer in Philosophy at Monash University in Melbourne. She was talking there with producer Sam Barron, and her book is Contours of Dignity, available through Oxford University Press. More info on the Philosopher's Zone website, where you can also find an archive of all of our past programs for streaming or download. And of course, you can get all the podcasts via any old podcast app, although we do recommend the ABC Listen app because that's your one-stop shop for all those other ABC audio goodies. I'm David Rutledge. I hope you can join me next week. In the meantime, you can yell at me on Twitter at David P. Zone. Bye for now.